Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Esther chapter 5. I will entitle chapter 5, Haman Plans to Hang Mordecai. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 4, Mordecai, realizing that the king of Persia, Xerxes, had issued a decree sent out to all the provinces of the Persian Empire, stating that the Jews were to be executed and annihilated on Adar 13. He had done that because Mordecai, Esther's adoptive father and first cousin, had refused to bow down to Haman. Haman got mad, blamed all the Jews because Mordecai was Jewish. And as a result, the Jews are in bad trouble. But by God's providence, the lot cast for that, the Purim, the lots, were cast in Nisan of the 12th year of Xerxes, but the execution was not chosen to be carried out until Adar the 13th, which is the 12th month, and so there was lots of time to do something about it. And during that time, Mordecai decided he would go to Queen Esther and say, "Esther, please, you got to do something. You're the queen." Esther kicked against it a little bit. She says, "Nah, the king hadn't seen me for 30 days. He's going to be upset. There's a law. I'm not supposed to just go into his throne room uninvited. And if I violate that law, I will be subject to the death penalty." And Mordecai says, basically, "What have you got to lose? He's going to kill you anyway." And so then Esther says, "Okay, I'll do it. But I want everybody to fast, all the Jews, to fast for me in the city in Susa for 3 days. No food, no water." So there's our context. We go to Esther 5, verses 1 through 2. On the third day, Esther dressed up in her royal clothing and stood in the inner courtyard of the palace, facing it. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the royal courtroom, facing its entrance. As soon as the king saw Queen Esther standing in the courtyard, she won his approval. The king extended the gold scepter in his hand toward Esther, and she approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Now, the time indicator here is on the third day. That's probably the third day of Esther's fast, as Gill and Clark suggest. When was this fast? Well, the lots were cast in Nisan, but that's during Passover. So it probably didn't happen then because Passover was a feast day, and it's hard to fast during a feast day. It couldn't be any later, this time frame here, later than the third month of the year, the 12th year of Xerxes, because the third month was Sivan, and that was the month that the king Xerxes sent out his edict that, "Well, I can't revoke the edict saying that you guys in the provinces can kill the Jews, but I'm sending out another edict saying that they can kill you, the retaliatory edict, I'll call it." That was in Sivan, the third month. And so it's somewhere in that time period here. Not much time has gone by, a couple months at the most. So Esther quits her mourning. She dresses up in her royal clothing. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out, given the emergency, she wasn't above using her natural charms. She looked nice for the king. Well, that makes sense. She stood in the inner courtyard of the palace facing it. So the courtyard, I assume it's open to the sky, facing the palace, and you go through the door there and you enter the throne room of the king. It might have been a covered courtyard, I don't know. The king is sitting in the courtroom on his throne, which means he's facing the door. So as Esther walks through that door, she's walking right into the presence of the king. He can see her. It makes sense that a king would do that because he could see anybody coming in the door, including potential assassins. Now, of course, Queen Esther is violating the law doing this, but as soon as she came in, she won Xerxes' approval, it says in verse 2. Now, this is quite remarkable and providential. He had not seen Esther for 30 days. We read that in the last chapter, verse 11, second part of the verse. "And I have not been summoned," Esther says, "to come to the king for these 30 days. That possibly indicated that he was displeased with her. I talked about in the last audio. There's arguments both ways on that. It might be he was just too busy with all his pretty little concubine virgins that he was toying with, and he just hadn't gotten around to Esther lately. But it could be that Haman had influenced him negatively towards Esther. Haman might have even told Xerxes that Esther was Jewish. That's all speculation. We don't know, but we do know that she had transgressed a very famous law of the Persians by coming in to the throne room unasked, and she was risking her neck doing that. Now, the Septuagint adds some very interesting details. These are quoted by Adam Clark. Quote, the king as being at first greatly enraged when he saw Esther because she had dared to appear before him unveiled, and she, perceiving this, was so terrified that she fainted away, on which the king, touched with tenderness, sprung from his throne, took her up in his arms, laid the golden scepter on her neck, and spoke to her in the most endearing manner. I don't know where the Septuagint got that from, but that sure makes the story a lot more interesting. I've never heard it before. But at any rate, Esther's passed the first hurdle. She's not going to be killed. Touching the golden scepter, by the way, or extending the golden scepter by the king, is the traditional way the Persian king showed forgiveness for breaking the law. We read about that in Esther 4, last chapter, verse 11. Esther's speaking. She's passing messages to Mordecai, and she says, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live." The king holds out the golden scepter. Esther touches the golden scepter. Touching the golden scepter was the usual way of acknowledging the royal condescension not to take her head off. Touching it showed reverence and submission, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. We go to verse 3, Esther 5. "Then the king said to her, 'What is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be given to you.'" Well, half of the kingdom, that's exaggeration. Of course he's not going to give her half the kingdom. That's a stock phrase, as the NIV Study Bible and John Gill say. It is obviously not meant to be taken literally. It means, "I'll give you anything you want, Queen Esther." Why was Xerxes so generous? Well, the NIV Study Bible suggests that Xerxes knew that Esther would not risk her life to approach him for a small matter. And so he knew something big was up. Esther had aroused his admiration and curiosity, admiration for her bravery and curiosity, because he's thinking, what in the world does she want? We go now to Esther 5, verses 4 through 8. Esther said, "If it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him." So this is the big news. We're going to have a banquet. Esther wants to have a banquet. She's risking her life to ask me if she wants to have a banquet for me. Well, Xerxes seemed favorably impressed. He was not put off by the request. Verse 5, "Then the king said, 'Bring Haman quickly that we may do as Esther desires.' So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared." Well, Xerxes is in a pretty good mood. So that's what Esther wants. She wants to have a banquet. Okay, we'll have a banquet. Verse 6, "As they drank their wine at the banquet," and I'm going to call this the first banquet because Esther's going to propose a second banquet later on, but this is the first banquet. "As they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, 'What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you.'" So we see there that actually the petition was not to have a banquet. Xerxes realizes that she was not just asking him to have a banquet. She's got something else up her sleeve in mind, and he's still curious about it. "What is your request?" he says. "Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done." So he repeats that stock phrase, even as he had in his throne room. So Esther replied, "My petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says." So now Xerxes is thinking, so this is her petition, is to have a second banquet? So at first he thinks, oh, what does she want? She wants to have a banquet. Well, wait a minute, it must be more than that. Oh, now there's another petition, to have another banquet. Well, Xerxes must realize that Esther's playing some kind of game here, and he's curious. He wants to know what's going on. Now, for the second banquet, well, for the first banquet, Haman was invited. Here's some options as to why she invited Haman. John Gill suggests it's so that she could accuse Haman to his face, and also when no one else was around. Now think about it, if there were other courtiers present, and she accused Haman of being a lying, murdering SOB, or whatever she's going to say, there would have been confusion, arguments, oh, don't say that about a Haman, he's the prime minister. But this is alone with the king. Clark suggests the reason, or one of the reasons, that Esther invited Haman to this banquet was to prevent Haman's suspicion. Away from the banquet, he might have conspired against Esther, we already know, as we're going to see here in a minute, that Haman, at the instigation of his wife, has built a gallows to hang Esther's cousin on, Mordecai, 75 feet high. So at least Esther figures that by having Haman at the banquet, he's not going to be doing anything against her. So Esther was very smart as well as beautiful. Her plan worked. Haman was utterly surprised at his quick downfall, which we're getting to. And also, the banquet is going to put Xerxes in a good mood. Now, God, of course, is providentially arranging all this, but looking at it from our point of view, from the natural point of view, there's nothing wrong with using wiles when doing God's work. And in this case, it was feminine wiles. They work great sometimes, especially when working on a man. She's feeding him wine. And of course, wine is going to put you in a good mood too. So Esther's working overtime here. Verse 5 says, "Bring Haman quickly that we may do as Esther desires." In other words, bring Haman quickly so we can have this banquet. Quickly. That quickly indicates something. It probably indicates that Xerxes is probably dying to find out what in the world Esther was up to. Now let's look at a Persian custom here as they drink wine in verse 6. Esther, Haman, and the king, Xerxes. At Persian banquets, the king ate alone during the first part of the banquet, and the rest of the people in the banquet, sitting apart, drank water, not wine. That, of course, shows how exalted the emperor is. And then at the second part of the banquet, the guests moved in with the king. They all drank together, ate and drank together, and the guests drank wine at the second part of the banquet. Now, I don't know, with this informal banquet here with just three people, that Persian protocol was followed. Now, notice that Xerxes keeps asking Esther for her petition. Well, her petitions so far have just been for banquets. I'm just speculating here that what Esther might have done is to do this. Xerxes, I want to have a banquet for you, and then I'll ask you what I want. And so that's why he keeps saying, well, what's your petition? It's more than just this banquet. I think it's because she must have tipped him off somehow that I'm getting ready to ask you something big, something else. And he's curious. But Esther's still playing the tease here. She doesn't immediately ask her petition. She says, here's my petition in verse 7. Here's my petition. Let's have another banquet tomorrow with you and Haman. Xerxes must be enjoying these banquets, so he went along with it. Okay, I'll play along with you. So they were going to have a banquet the next day, tomorrow. And then tomorrow I will do as the king says, Esther says. In other words, tomorrow I will reveal my petition to you, Xerxes. Now here's some options as why Esther waited until the second banquet to make her request. Option number one, to tease Xerxes in order to make it more curious. This, of course, waiting for the second banquet would make Xerxes more focused on Esther and her request at the expense of whatever else the king was doing. Option number two, the reason Esther waited until the second banquet was to increase the dramatic effect of the request, to let the king know that something very, very important was up. Option number three, that option number two, by the way, was from Gill, to increase the dramatic effect. Option number three is suggested by Gill in the NIV Study Bible, to butter up Xerxes some more. Two banquets were better than one. Adam Clark suggests that Esther may not have felt confident that Xerxes was won over with just one banquet. Here's option number four. Esther could have, understandably, lost her nerve at the critical moment at banquet number one, and she might have thought, well, let's do this tomorrow. Well, for whatever reason, she postponed her request to a second banquet. It was all under God's sovereign plan and purpose, because the postponement to the second day, the postponement of presenting the petition till the second day, gave Xerxes enough time to read his chronicles and discover Mordecai's previous service and what a great guy he was. And of course, that led to the remarkable downfall of Haman and the elevation of Mordecai, all of which we'll read about in chapters 6 and 7. We go now to Esther 5, verses 9 through 10. Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Now, of course, Mordecai does not stand up and bow down to Haman. Xerxes had ordered everybody in the kingdom to bow down to Haman, and there's some question as whether this was just to show him civil respect as a prime minister or whether it was to show him religious honor, divine honor. It has to be divine honor that was requested by Xerxes, and of course, a divine prostration before a human being is not allowed to a Jew. Now, how do we know it was divine honor? I went over this in the last audio. I'll briefly go over it again. First of all, this special homage to Haman was commanded by the king. The king's not going to command that kind of homage if it was just ordinary civil respect that was commanded, because That's natural. You don't need to command that. No king needs to command that. Also, Mordecai wouldn't have refused to give mere civil homage. He refused to bow down religiously, but if it had just been respect, he would have done that. Jews did that. David did that to Saul, 1 Samuel 24:8. Also, it would have been stupid for Mordecai not to bow down and give civil homage and respect to Haman, because by not doing so, he would lose his office, and he also would get all the Jews killed, is what was about to happen because of that edict. If it was just civil homage that was asked for, Mordecai would never have refused to bow down. And also, to refuse to bow down, if that was all that was requested, was civil respect, not to give civil respect would be a mere act of pride, and that's outside of Mordecai's character. This is obviously an act of conscience, not an act of pride. So this is obviously divine worship that has been requested by Xerxes, divine worship of Haman. And besides all that, the Hebrew word implies divine worship, as Adam Clark points out. So that's the reason, basically, that Haman would not bow down to him, because Haman was asking for divine worship. But also, it could be that Mordecai knew that Haman had concocted the scheme to destroy the Jews. I'm not sure how he would have known that. I don't think the text says so, but it's a logical assumption. I think the word would have gotten around. And it's quite natural that Mordecai wouldn't bow down to somebody that's threatened to annihilate the whole Jewish race. John Gill suggests there's another reason he didn't bow down. Mordecai was supremely confident that Esther's petition was going to succeed, Gill says. Therefore, he had nothing to fear from Haman. I think that's a stretch. I think Mordecai was throwing himself onto the sovereignty of God, and he was in deep doo-doo here. He was asking for divine help. He wasn't all that confident in the natural that he was going to win, that he was going to stop this edict of the Persians that could not be repealed. And he's supremely confident? Gil, I don't think so. But in verse 10, we see, as Haman looks at Mordecai refusing to bow, Haman was filled with anger, but he controlled himself. Why did he control himself? John Gill suggests that it was below Haman's dignity to avenge himself on one single person when he was about to kill the whole race of Jews. Well, there's a problem with that, in my opinion. Very shortly here, at the end of this chapter, we will see that Haman took his wife Zeresh's suggestion to build a gallows for Mordecai. He didn't feel that killing one Jewish official, Mordecai, was beneath his dignity. Of course, that happened later after Zeresh urged him on to it. Maybe at the time that Haman saw Mordecai refusing to bow, he thought, well, I'm not going to mess with this little ant. I'll get him later. He might not have been able to think of a dignified way to call out Mordecai in front of all the officials. It would have caused a scene. Maybe he just wanted to wait to nail Mordecai on Adar the 13th when all the other Jews got killed. At any rate, Mordecai is offended enough that he goes to his house so he can brag about what a big shot he was. We read this in verses 11 through 14, and we will be finished with Esther 5. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches. The them there is referring to Zeresh, his wife, and all of his friends in his house. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared, and tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends said to him, have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Now in verse 11, Haman recounts to Zeresh, his wife, and all of his friends the glory of his riches, his positions, his honor with Xerxes, and all of that. It was probably to make up for the slight that he had received from Mordecai, as John Gill says. I'm telling you, this Haman was one conceited person. He brags even about the number of his sons. He had 10 sons. They were all killed later by Jews retaliating against the Persians who were enabled to kill them. In Esther 9:10, it mentions the 10 sons of Haman. They're listed out by name in the previous verses that got killed. Asiatic kings delighted in the number of their children. Look what a man I am. Look how many illegitimate bastards I have. How many sons of concubines I have, how many wives I have, how many children my wives have got. In fact, that's why they take so many wives and concubines, so they can have so many children. Look at what Solomon did. This is typical in the Eastern Oriental thinking. Well, as Haman continues to pump up his bruised ego, he mentions as the crowning event that shows what a big shot he was, even Esther the queen asked me to come to the banquet. John Gill says it sounds like Esther's honor, the honor of Esther that was given to Haman, was the thing that puffed up Haman the most. Ah, but it was going to be the thing that destroyed him. But all that honor did not compensate for the dishonor that Mordecai the Jew, sitting at the king's gate, gave to Haman. So here Zeresh and the friends, probably Zeresh, his wife, said, well, okay, does that bother you so much? Well, let's just hang him. Build a gallows and hang him before you go to the banquet. Now, I suspect that Haman had not thought about hanging Mordecai when he went by Mordecai that last time at the gate, and Mordecai didn't bow down to him. It just probably didn't occur to him. I can't kill him now. I'll wait to Adar the 13th. But Zeresh says, why don't you just do it now? And Haman says, that's a good idea. So he had the gallows made. Now, you notice that even though Mordecai made the gallows, he apparently did not have the authority to put Mordecai on the gallows, because Mordecai was a king's official. In verse 14, it says Haman, or Zeresh, said to Haman, you need to ask the king to have Mordecai hanged. But Haman probably figured the answer would be yes, given the honor that Haman had received from the king by inviting him to his private tete-a-tete with the queen. Now, this gallows, which was going to be built by Haman's workers, was 50 cubits high. That's 75 feet. Why so high? Well, it was to make a greater public spectacle of Mordecai. Everybody would look up there and see him hanging on the gibbet. This is Adam Clark says that. I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, the NIV Study Bible says there's a problem here. How could such a high gallows have been built in one night? So they suggest that perhaps the gallows were built on top of a wall or a house, a flat-roofed house, which would make the total height from ground to top 75 feet. Well, I don't know. It's just gallows. You got a whole night to work. The workers, knowing that Haman was a very big shot, they obviously would work hard. And it's not like they're building a house. They're just building a wooden structure. I think they could do it in one night. I don't know. But I don't think it's a problem like the NIV Study Bible thinks it is. Now, these gallows that are built could be not a gallows, but a stake. As Adam Clark and the NIV Study Bible point out, I've already mentioned this in Esther 2 when we talked about the conspiracy of Bigthan and Teresh, how they got caught and they were hanged on the gallows. That might have been they were impaled on a stake. And in one of my old commentators' florid language says that the stake was inserted into the fundament of the victim. The fundament, that means his rear end. And the stake went up through his body and came out by the side of his neck. And it took a while for the deceased to die in agony. Well, if it's a stake 75 feet high, I guess you balance it with guy wires, maybe. I don't know. I guess it would make it easier to build in one night to solve the NIV Study Bible's problem of how it could be done in one night. Well, we'll never know exactly what it was that was being built to kill Mordecai, but we do know that cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree. And of course, a tree sounds like a stake more than a gallows. But at any rate, doesn't really matter if it was a tree rather than a gallows. That would be unwittingly fulfilling the Hebrew law, the Jewish law. That would make the deaths of Haman and his sons more significant. Ah, you're cursed because you violated God's law. All of that's nice speculation. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Esther chapter 5. We're now prepared to go in our next audio to Esther chapter 6, in which we will see the king honors Mordecai. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.